23rd, 2020. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflow.
And I'm Pam Vidor.
And we are back with another chapter of the last Sherlock Holmes novel, The Valley of Fear. This is chapter 3, where we learn all about the tragedy of Birlstone.
Oh, excellent. Can we do the Christopher Lee part, The Valley of Fear?
Ooh, I like that.
That's very Star Wars of you.
All right, so I wanted to do a little background for us, and the first thing I wanted to say is this chapter certainly is going to have our American introduction to it also, or connection, I would say. We're going to think about the 1800s. We have Manifest Destiny going on. The Wild West of the United States certainly is a very exciting place to be. Certainly for Doyle, it's something that's top of mind. It's in the news, and people are getting wealthy out there. But Manifest Destiny for the United States is a cultural belief that the United States has a special mission to basically conquer the entire part of North America. It's a mission to take all the bad stuff in the old world, and we're going to get it right this time. And it's not really ever a really defined mission. It's just sort of this idea that we're special, and because we're so special, this is going to be a special mission in the world. Certainly, that was not a great description of it. But I do know that instead of thinking about it in today's awareness and sort of what that may have played out to be, we need to think of it in how Doyle would have thought about it and the readers would have thought about it at the time. We also need to be aware of when California became part of the United States, because I think California is going to have play as important in this chapter and eventually in this story. So in February of 1848, Mexico and the United States signed a treaty that was ending the Mexican-American War, and Mexico yielded it's basically everything north of the Rio Grande River at the border of Texas, and then kind of straight off towards the coast. Everything north of that. In January 24th, 1848, gold was discovered in California, all the way from Jamestown in the founding, or the first settlers coming over to the United States. They'd been looking for gold, and this set off the gold rush. And this is this, we went from a few people to like 300,000 people being in California. This set up 1850. California needed a government. They became a state. And it was part of something called the Great Compromise. California, even today, is an incredible place. It's got about $3.2 trillion gross state product. You know, if you had to put it in the world stage, is how big the economy of California is. It's the fifth largest economy in the world. It's ahead of India, but behind Germany. So when you think of how big of an impact California makes on the world, it is incredible. Put it in comparison, we're roughly a third of the economy here in Illinois, where we are. It's, the economic power of Illinois is about $857 billion in 2018. New York is about $1.7 trillion, and that's the third largest economy in the United States. And if you add it up, the state of Illinois and the state of New York's economy, where you get roughly what the United Kingdom's current gross domestic product is, about $2.7 trillion. So there's all of our background as we move towards our story.
And that's our story of Sherlock Holmes, folks.
Woo! Okay, now, interesting, Chip, to set it up that way. Because, in fact, this is a story that Watson sets up a little bit, as Chip just has. This chapter, he opens by saying, "Now, for a moment, I will ask leave to remove my own insignificant personality and to describe events which occurred before we arrived upon the scene by the light of knowledge which came to us afterward. Only in this way can I make the reader appreciate the people concerned and the strange setting in which their fate was cast." And so Watson and Holmes are not in this chapter, just so you know. We get the police who are sort of waiting for Holmes to arrive. Mm-hmm. So Watson and Holmes, they're not even in this chapter. It's so funny. And yet I think it's quite a fascinating chapter, despite the fact that our heroes aren't in it. Did you guys like this chapter okay?
I did. I in fact, what I was amazed with was how well Doyle kind of set up the whole chapter. It's like, we're going to bring you into this. It's all just, we need this information to get started with our story.
But do you think that he needed to state that in this way? Do you think that it was necessary for him to break the third wall and to explain that he's going to be explaining something that is not first-person narrative? Or has he done the opposite so many times and just given us description and it's fine?
The author's contract said there would be 16 chapters, Steve.
You always go back to that. That is always your opinion of all writing, that it's contractual.
No, but I actually think that here, because imagine, like, we're getting chapter 3 1 month after we read chapter 2, and we're like, wait a minute, Holmes and Watson aren't even in it. I understand why he was like, okay, guys, just give me a pass here. I have a bunch of information to give you. It's quite interesting, and we're going to be right back. Right?
Yeah, okay. All right. One month from now. Forgot about the 1 month part. You are absolutely right. This is easing us back into the story from a month ago, and it's not a huge info dump. This is put together in a great narrative fashion, even though the narration is different. Okay, fine.
Okay. And here's the thing. The murder is super fascinating, and so is the setting. Mm-hmm. So I actually love, the manor house, the Burlstone house, with its many gables and its small diamond-paned windows, was still much as the builder had left it in the early 17th century. Of the double moats which had guarded its more warlike predecessor, the outer had been allowed to dry up and serve the humble function of a kitchen garden. The inner one was still there and lay 40 feet in breadth, though now only a few feet in depth, round the whole house. A small stream fed it and continued beyond it, so that the sheet of water, though turbid, was never ditch-like or unhealthy. The ground floor windows were within a foot of the surface of the water. I thought that was a super interesting detail. Just imagine living in this giant house surrounded by a moat.
Mm-hmm. Right? With a drawbridge.
The only approach to the house was over a drawbridge, the chains and windlass of which had been long rusted and broken. The latest tenants of the manor house had, however, with characteristic energy, set this right. And the drawbridge was not only capable of being raised, but actually was raised every evening and lowered every morning.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, it sounds like a great place to live, right?
Uh-huh.
It sounds like almost a fantasy where you pull in your drawbridge.
Yeah.
Back down.
And you have that daily schedule of when it's open and when it's closed.
Yes.
And that becomes a part of the town, that becomes the event of the town, is very interesting.
Well, in fact, my initial thought was, how many wealthy people have taken over, you know, some castle in some, you know, far off area, only to find out it is the ultimate money pit.
Mm-hmm. And this is inspired by a real moated house in Kent, which really does feature these amazing to us pieces of folklore, really. The moat and the drawbridge. A very intriguing concept.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, this is the manor house. So it actually is reminding you of the feudal society that used to be there. This is the big house, right?
Mm-hmm. We get to the characters here, and boy, do we have some very interesting characters in this puzzle.
John Douglas, the man who has been killed, is described as a remarkable man, both in character and in person. In age, he may have been about 50, with a strong jawed, rugged face, a grizzling mustache, peculiarly keen gray eyes, and a wiry, vigorous figure, which had lost nothing of the strength and activity of youth. He was cheery and genial to all, but somewhat offhand in his manners, giving the impression that he had seen life in social strata on some far lower horizon than the County Society of Sussex. Chip, we know where that was, don't we?
South of London, on the coast area.
On the channel, right across from the rest of mainland Europe.
And certainly John Douglas sounds very much like a guy that is in had been to California, sort of made his way there, and certainly is described as an incredibly generous person, or they have a generous family.
Well, and I think that's what, you know, he had seen life in a social strata a little bit lower. That's what it means, California, I think, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's lived in America for quite a long time. So that...
He came back wearing Levi's because that's what they wear.
And then there's this very interesting detail about him. So the good impression which had been produced by his generosity and by his democratic manners was increased by a reputation gained for utter indifference to danger. So this is a guy who, right, like he's like not a great rider, but he rides his horse in like this sort of, challenging race or whatever. So this guy is afraid of nothing. He's an American, he's a British guy who's made his fortune in America.
Yosemite Sam type character. Always getting a crate from Acme with things to blow up stuff with. No problems there.
His middle name is Danger.
That's right. Self-described.
Have I ever told you that story? One of my administrators at school named his son, his middle name is Danger on his birth certificate. That is a true thing that boy will have for the rest of his life. You're welcome, son. We get to Mrs. Douglas. Mrs. Douglas is certainly another one of those beautiful, tall, dark women that Doyle seems to really enjoy writing about, and she is some 20 years younger than her husband, another thing that Doyle tends to put into his stories, huh?
Oh, and the good news is this disparity in age seemed in no wise to mar the contentment of their family life.
That's a little judgmental, Doyle. Jeez.
Male-centric view of marriage.
Of its time.
Now, here's the interesting detail about Mrs. Douglas in my mind. It had also been noted and commented upon by a few observant people that there were signs sometimes of some nerve strain upon the part of Mrs. Douglas, and that she would display acute uneasiness if her absent husband should ever be particularly late in his return. On a quiet countryside, where all gossip is welcome, this weakness of the lady of the manor house did not pass without remark, and it bulked larger upon people's memory when the events arose which gave it very special significance. Hmm. Now, I love how he writes that. So, okay, this is like a place where, hey, guess what? You live in the manor house. Everyone's watching your every move. Mm-hmm.
TMZ.
Right? People love to gossip. And they notice that she gets nervous if her husband is late.
And while this is not directly related to the sign of four, it just seems like there's some kind of connection as far as looking at the world, or at least the Western United States. There, and I haven't figured out what that connection is, but this certainly, like, this sort of reminds me of the sign of four, even though it's totally different.
Well, you pointed out all of the news of California that was coming through to England, and Doyle was one of those people who was certainly really interested in what life was like in this new world.
Yeah, there's like a travelogue quality to it, and you guys, it's going to come back to Study in Scarlet as well, right? Idea of like, what does America look like right now? Mm-hmm. And then interestingly, you don't expect a third person to be living in this household of this childless couple. We now meet Cecil Barker, an easygoing, free-handed gentleman, said Ames the butler. But my word, I had rather not be the man that crossed him. He was cordial and intimate with Douglas, and he was no less friendly with his wife, a friendship which more than once seemed to cause some irritation to the husband, so that even the servants were able to perceive his annoyance. Such was the third person who was one of the family when the catastrophe occurred. That's weird, right? Why would they have this other guy living with them who kind of seems like he makes the husband jealous? He's halfway between age of the 50-ish year old husband and the 30-ish year old wife. Cecil's is in his 40s. That's interesting that the servants have noted this sort of tension around attentions to Mrs.
I should write that down as my note.
Mr. Douglas! Sorry. I couldn't resist. I've been thinking it for the whole chapter. Mr. Douglas, I gotta explain.
Yeah, there's something going on. We're gonna find out.
A mystery of some sort. Who knew? There are two important servants. There's plenty of other servants in the house that are dismissed immediately, but there are two important servants, the prim, respectable, and capable Ames, and Mrs. Allen, a buxom and cheerful person. The buxom got me. I was like, Doyle, come on. Come on now. There are six other servants that have no bearing on the case is what is written in the chapter. Like, okay, dismiss those six people.
I mean, you need to have a certain number of servants for a household with a drawbridge, but trust me, you only need to pay attention
to
this
definition of buxom something about a warm and friendly person anyway?
No, that's not what that word means. The details of the case are revealed here in Chapter 3. Cecil Barker arrives at the police station near midnight and brings the police back because they immediately call the police. How about that? An actual murder where they immediately call the police. This is unusual for Doyle.
Call the sheriff. No,
Mr. Douglas is found dead in the library wearing his dressing gown over his night clothes, a pink dressing gown. Is that a red herring?
No.
A
pink was a gentleman's color. It was a man's color. And that flipped, interestingly enough. There's a story, you can look it up if you want to, where pink moved from being the masculine color to blue being the masculine color, and pink moving to be the feminine color, basically denoting female. And that happened, I can't remember, maybe in the early 1900s or so. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
He was shot in the face!
With a sawed-off shotgun, Steve.
A sawed-off shotgun, which Doyle reports as a curious weapon, because they don't know from sawed-off shotguns in England just as much as we do here in the United States.
Americans are unrefined. I just want to point that out.
This is my boomstick! Good. Pam, you don't get that reference. That's okay. That's all right.
I'm sorry.
Oh, Evil Dead. So anyway, Barker heard the shots around 11:30, and he and the servants kept Mrs. Douglas from seeing the victim. That was a very nice moment in this, where they said, no, Mrs. Douglas, you don't need to see what's going on here.
Well, we find out why. He was shot in the face.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, which we had found out in the previous chapter when Inspector Mac was telling Sherlock and Watson, listen, it didn't say horrible in the official document, but you can imagine someone shot in the face is a pretty hideous scene.
But we have some very specific clues, right?
Yes, this is definitely Doyle laying out the case for us very well here.
So the drawbridge was up. And the drawbridge was pulled up at 6 o'clock. And so whoever came in must have come into the house before 6 o'clock. And then how did he leave, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, and even the drawbridge being up is important to note because it went up at 6 o'clock. And normally it would go up around 4:30, maybe, you know.
At sunset.
At sunset, which was, you know, it gives you another idea of what time of year this is.
January 6th.
Mm-hmm.
One of the few cases that has that very specific date.
There was a card found beside the dead man, the initials VV, and under them the number 341 were rudely scrawled in ink upon it. Rudely. How rudely can you scrawl? Pretty rudely, actually.
Well, that's pretty interesting. How would you know a rude scrawl from a less rude scrawl, Steve?
Font is very important. We have had this discussion in design class, in my class, often. Is if you choose a font that means angry and you write a love letter, it's misunderstood when it's received. Rudely scrawled.
Okay. There's also a hammer on the floor in front of the fireplace. And Cecil Barker's like, oh yeah, Douglas was fixing a picture on the wall earlier in the day. That must be from that.
It was pretty easily dismissed, wasn't it? It was pretty easily dismissed. Like, yeah, he had a hammer because he was working on the pictures on the wall. Okay. I don't believe you.
I think Watson would probably come to the same conclusion.
you're right. You're absolutely right. These characters are certainly trying their best to solve this case and possibly not observing, only seeing. Yeah, well, you're right.
There's a picture up on the wall. Of course he's there with a hammer.
Mm-hmm. The dead man has a brand on his arm, a curious brown design, a triangle inside a circle, standing out in vivid relief upon the lard-colored skin. Yes, the lard-colored skin got me.
I know.
Boy, I think that is like the worst description. Like, oh, sit down for dinner with all your family and you say your lard-colored skin. I think that no one would take that personally.
But it's interesting that at first they think it might be a tattoo, and then the doctor says, "Ooh, you guys, like, I've never seen this before, but this is a brand, like how they brand cattle, right?"
Mm-hmm.
Very Western.
And you can kind of hear in the United States.
Mm-hmm. His wedding ring is missing. This seems to be a really big clue, doesn't it, Pam?
Well, it does, because for the wedding ring was actually under another ring. So the police who are initially on the scene say then the murderer or whoever it was first took off this ring you call the nugget ring, then the wedding ring, and afterward put the nugget ring back again. That's quite a thing to do to a body with this head shot off, is to actually remove the wedding ring.
And then to replace the other ring. That is quite a clue that we've got there. It's quite a nugget.
But this idea of taking the time to remove a ring, and then placing that ring back on, it just seems a little over the top. So, yes, there's something important there that Watson will miss.
And the wedding ring being a symbol of a relationship. I'm intrigued.
And the brand wasn't?
Certainly, that's a different relationship. Yeah. That is certainly the symbol of a different relationship, but that was not taken. That was left. Because taking a brand would be very difficult.
Which is okay for me. Okay, so now the local police seem to realize instantly that they are not up to the task of this very mysterious situation. "We'd best put it back on the rug where we found it," said the sergeant, scratching his puzzled head in his perplexity. Not to put too fine a point on it. He's both puzzled and perplexed. It will want the best brains in the force to get to the bottom of this thing. It will be a London job before it is finished.
Mm-hmm.
Which brings us to the chapter's ending. And again, we've got this worthy country policeman. Worthy country policeman shook his head. "Seems to me the sooner we get London onto this case, the better," said he. "White Mason is a smart man. No local job has ever been too much for White Mason. It won't be long now before he is here to help us. But I expect we'll have to look to London before we are through. Anyhow, I'm not ashamed to say that it is a deal too thick for the likes of me." Chapter. And so you'll notice he mentions London three times in the notion. He really doesn't want to get this wrong.
Right?
This is a manor house. This is one of the sort of personages of this area who has been killed. And it looks like just the kind of job that's not really suited for this small Sussex police force. And presumably we're soon going to meet White Mason. And this guy understands his own limits. And that's something that Sherlock Holmes is likely to appreciate, as we know from having just spent 59 stories with him.
And I'd like to thank both of you for pointing out my limits on a daily basis.
Well, you're sometimes puzzled and perplexed in the same sentence.
At the same time?
I mean, geez, Doyle. Puzzled and perplexed in the same sentence. Wow. Doyle is laying this out for us really well. This is one of those mysteries that I feel like we are going to have the chance of understanding the solution maybe before Watson does on this one, because he's really laying it out well. This is great narrative. This chapter has all the information that we need, but it's not an info dump. I enjoy chapter 3.
So what we're saying is that it's all set up for chapter 4, which they had to wait a month for, but we get to see it tomorrow.
And I love the title of chapter 4, Darkness.
No pants! Good. Continued darkness.
I wonder what it's about.
So yes, join us tomorrow for chapter 4, Darkness. And we would love to hear from you. Are you enjoying this as much as we are? Are you getting ready for school like I am? And Pam is. Not Chip. Chip's not going to school. But that's okay. He's got other stuff he'll get ready for. We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text. Send us an email. Follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes for all of that conversation. And go to our dedicated Sherlock Holmes website, sandwiches@irregularhours.com, for all of these conversations all in one convenient place. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hessenflor.
And I'm Pam Bedore. Welcoming you to the Valley of Fear. What I want to talk about is what I want to thank you for.